The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
How are you? It's a small crowd here tonight. It's weird. God, it's no one here. On behalf of the Free Library of Philadelphia, I want to welcome you to tonight's event with Chuck Palahniuk. My name is Dwayne Swierczynski. I'm a crime novelist, write stuff set here in Philadelphia. I write two series for Marvel Comics, and I'm the only one of the few American authors who has a more difficult last name than Mr. Palahniuk. So backstage, he was actually, you know, marveling at this, and I said, well, you know, you're my hero, Chuck. You broke the surname barrier. You know, after Chuck, it's something that's cool to have ridiculous surnames. It's a wave of the future. Anyway, I want to tell you guys about what the plan is tonight. Thanks for your patience hanging out. I know we're a little late to start with. Chuck will come out and say hi in a little bit. He'll also read a few fairy tales. And I don't want to ruin the suspense for you, but there may be some games and maybe some prizes. Maybe. Afterward, I'll do a quick or a 25-minute Q&A with Chuck on stage here, and followed by two questions from the audience. So raise your hand fast, I guess, or, you know, do something. Yeah, that's fast. That's fast. Afterward, there'll be more fairy tales, more games, maybe more prizes, maybe, I don't know. And then finally, the signing will finish. But if you don't make it to the signing line, if you're not one of the lucky 150, there are pre-signed books available upstairs. So, you know, there is a chance. Anyway, it's my I'm very proud to present the author of Fight Club and the new Pygmy, Mr. Chuck Palahniuk.
Once again, I wanted to start out with something that I heard once when I was 18 years old. When I was 18 and I got out of high school, my first job in order to get money to start college was I was a messenger for the Oregonian, which is our daily paper in Portland, Oregon. And another messenger that I worked with, who was also 18 or 19 years old, just once said the following to me. "'Twas brillig in the slithy tovas, did gar and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy with the burrow rovas, and the mumras dot grabe. Beware the jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the jubjub bird and shun, the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the maxim foe he sought, till rested he neath the tumtum tree, and stood a while and thought. And while in uffish thought he stood, the jabberwock with eyes aflame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as he came. One, two, and through the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. Hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day, Calloo, Callay!" He chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig in the slithy tovas, did gar and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy with the burrogrovas, and the mumras doth grabe. That was in 1980. Most of you were not even born. And I don't even remember that kid's name. But he said that Lewis Carroll had written that poem, Jabberwocky, as a way of sticking it to the Scots And the whole thing is kind of a parody of the Scottish dialect. And most of the words are made up. But it still makes complete sense. And my entire life, teachers have been telling me, you gotta write this way, you gotta write clearly, you gotta write perfect, or you get an F. And I'm amazed that with Jabberwocky, it makes sense. Because when we hear a story, we are so sophisticated, we are so smart at figuring out the meaning. We so want to get it that we figure it out, we decipher it. And I was invited to do a tour in Germany a couple years ago, and in college I took 2 years of German, and I was so excited about the idea of using my old college German with real Germans. And I hired a tutor, and she and I met for breakfast 3 times a week for a couple months leading up to it. And I went to Germany, and I told the publicist, I said, I don't need a translator. I'm going to go on the radio, I'm going to go on the TV, and I'm going to speak German to these Germans. I can do this. And I went on Deutsche Nationalradio, German public radio, and I just spoke German like a son of a bitch. And I spoke German with the confidence that only an American can speak German. Damn it, Germans don't even speak German as good as I speak German. And I came out of that sound booth, and poor Susanna, the publicist, just stared at me. She said, did you think that that was funny? Do you think anybody in Germany thought what you said just now was funny? Do you think anybody in Europe? Because you were speaking to all of Europe on our state-owned radio network. Do you think anybody laughed at what you just said? Because I'm sure they did not. And she said, what were you trying to say? And I said, I was trying to say, ich habe seit 2 Jahren Deutsch studiert, aber doch, es tut mir leid, ich habe so viele Deutsche. And then I came to the verb. And the verb is vergessen, to forget. And I thought it was one of those irregular verbs. And in the past perfect, habe, I have forgotten, I thought it conjugated as vergast. And she said, you know, vergast is a past tense for to gas to death. And when you haul your stupid American ass to Germany with your ugly, flat American accent, and you try to say Deutsche, and you say Deutsche instead of Deutsche, you're saying German people. So what you actually just said by satellite to the entire European continent was, I am so sorry that I have gassed to death so many German people. And Susanna is saying, Cincy, I'm fucking retard. Kein Deutsch for you. No more German. You're not speaking any more German while you're inside our borders. And so after that, I was trying to limit myself to like the 6 words that I was confident about. Bitte, ja, auf Wiedersehen. And none of them are verbs. But I found that even with the really, atrociously lousy German, people understood me. I didn't know the word for today, or tomorrow, or yesterday. No, I didn't know the word for day. I did know today, heute. So for tomorrow, I would say, next heute. And for last week, I'd say, sieben heute nach. 7 todays ago. And God only knows what the German word is for glasses. So I would say, ich trage Augenfenster, which means I wear eye windows. And people still got it. He's an idiot, but he wears glasses. And so I thought, I bet I could write a book in English that is just as poor as my German. And people will get it. So I wrote Pygmy. And tonight I would like to, I'm not actually going to read from Pygmy, but I specifically wrote 3 what would be bedtime stories that would have been the kind of bedtime story that would have been read to Pygmy during his childhood, during his indoctrination by this unnamed fascist totalitarian government. And we're going to answer some questions, and we are going to play some games. So, to demonstrate the depth of my sad, pathetic life, I spent most of this winter inflating thousands of 3-foot penguins and signing them so they are all signed and dated and I never want to see them again. And what we're going to do at 3 different points throughout this evening is we're going to have kind of races to see who can inflate these penguins first. Don't start blowing till you get the signal, because cheaters never prosper. And once you get your penguin inflated, and I mean inflated smooth, it's got to be smooth like Lindsay Lohan, not wrinkly like Mother Teresa. But once you get it inflated, squeeze the left foot and it will squeak and I'll try to find you. And if you get the first one inflated, you get a DVD of the Choke movie from last year. Okay? Start blowing the penguins. Come on. Okay, and we'll do it 2 more times throughout the evening. Okay, where is it? Come on. Squeeze the foot. Okay. This guy is so red. Okay. Squeak the penguins, and then we'll keep moving on. Okay. So, these are actually, they're not technically bedtime stories. Technically, they are called Three Case Study for Generate Correct Right Thinking Perception Among Modern Citizen Youth of Today. And the first one. Case Study Operative Family Bear Mammals. Existed once time. Traditional heterosexual family unit composed mother bear mammal, father bear mammal, offspring bear mammal. Existing as proletariat family. Laboring for to bring total fruits much future success to most glorious nation state. As solely correct example, noble family of bear animals, occupy modest cottage containing practical durable furnishings, with foodstuffs provided by glorious, most generous state. As every all esteemed bear mammals native to state, mother bear mammal, father bear mammal, offspring bear mammal, all boast coats of most deep fur coloring. All bear animal display much strong vigor, great courage and intellect, performing top joyous to labor lifetime in dedication to enlightened vision of state. Occurring one occasion, did mother bear animal prepare breakfast meal consisting of stewed porridge. Through generous wealth, fuel wood provided by state, did finished porridge occur too vastly heated for immediate consumption by animal family. Instead, voted bear animals to labor, to vacate most comfortable domicile, and make labor within glorious salt mine, harvesting salt, for the more great glory of this top glorious national homeland. During absence, bear family from immaculate state-provided domicile, did arrive American trespasser criminal. Head of trespasser American, festooned decadent golden hairs, devil American criminal, in actual degenerate spoiled female youth, did violate vacant domicile of noble much laboring bear animals. Thereupon did American devil youth gorge own self consuming stewed porridge of breakfast meal, vociferous to declare initial hearty porridge of bear animals too heated. Next porridge, too chilled, final porridge, did glutton American greedily fully theft. Perhaps possible. Perhaps possible such youth related sister sibling of corrupt American heiress, Paris Hilton? Perhaps merely coincidence. Perhaps all, every citizen, United States, such finicky demon. Every always too hot, too cold, too dirty, too infested with lice. Foreign foodstuffs always too imbued with rodent feces. Too covered with larva of black housefly. No, never, nothing ever good quality enough for choosy American tourist. Upon devastate, breakfast porridge, did devil American of golden hairs experience extreme sloth, such typical of United States youth? Investigating state-provided sleeping mats, did devil child once more declare initial mat feel too solid. Declare second mat too yielding. Upon third mat, did lazy, slothful, trespass criminal achieve slumber? Sweet, much deep slumber. Next now, trio mighty proletariat bear mammals. Return subsequent diligent laboring in glorious salt mines of state. Mother bear animal, father bear animal with offspring. Did repeat enter own domicile. Did discover breakfast meal of stewed porridge consumed by trespasser. Next then, did trio of bear animal family make discovery of slothful American burglar making slumber upon state provided sleeping mat. Same now, golden hair, criminal awake, in manner of selfish coward American, make scream most loud prior to attempt flee. Springing for escape fate, in vain did United States devil thief leap from sleeping mat for attempt evade noble bear mammals. Nevertheless did claws of mother bear mammal seize trespasser by golden hair, halting escape. Quick next now did savage jaws of father bear animal sink jagged teeth into screaming windpipe of imperialist criminal. Entire domicile filled dying screams, spouting blood of decadent state enemy. Only last did offspring bear animal plunge own immature claws within ribcage of golden trespasser, seizing alive spasming heart muscle for to rip free of chest cavity. No digested porridge of breakfast meal did pour from eviscerated bowel flesh of captured thief. Within next now, criminal slaughtered and bear family feasting upon hot steaming corpse. Pausing only moment, so enable trio of such noble laboring animals for crane all heads backward upon necks, making vast howl in unison, howling over devastation of defeated American, howling did bear family shout, every all glory to be accomplished in honoring philosophy, the single correct homeland state. So, now you can see why every time I sit down to write, and it kind of serves me right, I deserve it because I use Microsoft Word. But every time I sit down to try to do my job, a little paperclip jumps up. With a little bug eyes and a little exclamation mark on everything it says. And it always says, I see you're trying to write literary fiction. And it starts out so polite. I always say, it's okay, little paperclip. Thanks anyway. Go back to hell where you came from. I can do this. And a couple words into whatever I'm writing, paperclip comes back up and says, you're not very good at this, are you? Don't take this personally. This is a paperclip. It says, but your subjects and your verbs don't agree very consistently. And your verb tense is all over the place. And you just don't have a very big vocabulary, do you? And I'm always, don't you have some papers to clip or something? I remember the day when paper clips were just, that's all they did. They didn't boss people around. They didn't try to change what you were writing. And I just, thank you anyway, it's my job, I can do this. And by the third or the fourth time, the paperclip is coming back up and saying things like, you suck. Bist du ein fucking retard? And I was like, fuck you, little paperclip. Well, there's cell phone reception in here. That's the good news. It's Maya Angelou. Oh, my gosh. She's sexting me. Which beats the hell out of when Thomas Pynchon sexts me. Hey, Maya? Oh, thanks for calling me back. Yeah. First off, you're just an extraordinary writer, and you know a ton of words. I mean, you know a lot of words. And I was just curious if you could tell me. Yeah, it's the paperclip. It's all over me. You too? Okay. Where'd you get your words? Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Yeah, I called Susan Sontag. She's dead? No, that's okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I believe that. Okay. Well, thanks anyway. Bye. Oh, my God. You think for a writer she could lie better than that? She says there's this magic book, and it's called a thesaurus. And whenever you need a word, you just open the magic thesaurus, and it's full of all these different words, and you just pick out the right word. She thinks I'm a fucking idiot. And I'm not, because I saw Jurassic Park. I know what a thesaurus is. Who here can forget when Laura Dern was screaming, "The thesaurus is out, run for your life!" So thank you, Maya. Okay. Squeak the penguins. Love the penguins. Who is heartbroken that they didn't get a penguin? Okay, we have a winner. And she didn't even blow up a penguin. Time for another bedtime story. And just a word to Kristen. Kristen, from this afternoon, who got off work at 7 o'clock, you still have to track me down and get that secret gift for your brother. No, that's not a euphemism. Case study, operative witch. Occurring once time, among past years much glorious history, this national state homeland, existed most wily, clever, female comrade witch, boasted such brilliant citizen witch, much copious intellect, labored much time, noble witch, for to construct entire own domicile, entire freestanding resident structure, employing solely sweetened confections, pastry baked goods, such variety, decadent luxury commodity, fabricate so brilliant, comrade witch, entire edifice crafted of many tasty sugar candy, for fireplace, chimney brick, composed infinite block, peppermint candy, shingle of domicile roof layered, waterproof from numerous narrow shingle licorice candy, house shutter for the shuttering window, shutter labored of dense chocolate fudge candy, side every wall composing house, builded from bread of ginger, embedded using corrupt amounts such delicious raisin fruit, with generous fragments crushed walnut. Talented citizen witch, exhaust much state resources, squander such vast quantities time for erect so tempting yum-yum house of sweet corruption. Despite seeming waste such effort, in secret, comrade witch, much stealthy predator, constitute brilliant political ally of state. Forever, forever crafty witch possess mind, utilize thinking machine of ticking clock. Forever patient citizen witch await, cunning comrade witch, serve constant vigilant every today, every passing night of today, until able listen, able witness with sensitive witch ear, sound of greedy American children's, endeavoring for to consume candy domicile. Typical, typical such selfish American children's, envision all total world planet crafted for solely satisfy own such greedy hungers. United States children's forever, forever reading silly book, forever listen with ear Sony Walkman device, forever every such devil children's immobile upon luxurious sofas for to view antics of American television Street of Sesame. So wicked. All American citizens such wicked. Traveling duo. Male boy with female girl children's. Firstly approach candy domicile. En route along pathway, traversing forested, much dense forested portion of this most glorious nation state. Experience such vulgar American children. No present hunger. Yet eager youths commence for gnawing upon bread of ginger house. Vapid American tongues lapping sweetness from fudge chocolate window shutter. Degraded, depraved children tooth, masticating for destroy all labor and resources of citizen witch, so merely digest and render as useless American feces. Upon discover such United States vermin, crafty witch announce, much welcome. Hospitable witch, bid devil children's devour until sated. Much admirable citizen witch, display infinite patient, for allow insatiable vile children's chew swallow, macerate sugary charms of clever candy house. Bid crafty citizen witch, invite children's, say, please, gluttonous, guest children's, say, witch, please share limited bounty of global petroleum resources. Much wise, much prudent, comrade witch, bid children's, please, no longer export such vast, degenerate product of American cultural imperialism. Still, such evil children's, no exhibit shame, no demonstrate remorse, merely remain greedy ravages plaguing locusts. Next now, mighty, righteous witch, subdue children's, witch, execute, exact, perfect, wham, pow, zebra death kick maneuver for render children's no conscience. Victorious, long-suffering citizen witch, mount for to bugger children's. Happy, most succeeding witch, bugger, 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 upon no conscious, rapacious American children's. Bugger, bugger, bugger. Now, victorious witch, mighty witch, champion, hero witch, sever every all blood vessel of American gluttons. Cleave unto pieces, riving apart arm and leg limb of selfish children's. Top most thriving comrade witch, witch teeth consuming alive meat, muscle spouting blood of slothful Americans, drenched in much hot blood of United States oppressor children, citizen witch shout, screeching loud shout, every all glory to be accomplished in honoring philosophy the single correct homeland state. Now we will try to answer some questions, and then we'll play one more round of penguins. Okay? Mr. Duane?
Yes, thank you.
My first question actually is, would you babysit my devil children sometime and read those stories to them?
Just in regards to those stories, I don't know how many people here were raised with the fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen, but he makes me look sane. Oh, my gosh. The fairy tales that we were raised with as little children were The Little Match Girl, which is about a homeless, tiny little girl living on the street selling matches, and it's freezing, and as she starts to freeze to death, she starts to light her matches, which are her only product for sale in a capitalist pig society. And with the first match, she envisions she's like at a beautiful feast, and with the second match, she envisions that she's in some other beautiful warm place, and suddenly she lights the entire box of matches, and for a moment she's warm and happy, and then she has no matches, and she freezes to death and dies. And the other story was about the tin soldier and the paper ballerina. And the paper, at the end, they were madly, deeply in love until a paper ballerina fell into the stove and burned up. And the heat of the stove melted the tin soldier into a lump of lead. And the other story, which was my favorite, was about statue of a noble prince in the middle of the prince's imperial city, and the statue was covered with gold, and it had ruby lips, and it had emerald eyes. It was the most beautiful statue ever. And winter was coming, and there was this little sparrow that lived on the statue, and it was time for the sparrow to go south. And the statue said, "Little sparrow, please help me. Winter's coming. And my people are hungry and they're cold, they're starving. So before you leave, before you go south, I need you to pull off my ruby lips and give them to the poor of my kingdom." And the little sparrow says, "Pull off your lips? Who do you think I am, Angelina Jolie?" But it pulls off the lips of this statue and it gives them to the poor. and it's about to take off for the south, and the statue says, "No, no, wait. I see some more poor, hungry people out there. I need you to rip out my emerald eyes." And the sparrow says, "Okay." And rips out the statue's eyes and takes them to the poor. And by then it's snowing and it's really cold. And the little sparrow is freezing. And it says, "Okay, see you next year." And the statue says, "No, no, no, wait. There's still poor people in my kingdom. I need you to rip off all of my gold skin and give it to the poor." And the little sparrow rips off all the gold leaf from the statue and takes it flake by flake to the poor. And then the sparrow freezes to death and dies at the foot of this ugly, corroded statue. And the people look up and they say, "God, that statue looks crappy." And they rip it down and they melt it and they make cannons out of it. The end. And that's what passed for a happy ending in my childhood. So.
Seriously, do you babysit ever? I mean, I could really use that kind of instruction. Actually, I do want to start with a question that may be a little dry and academic, so forgive me in advance. But Chuck, could you demonstrate the giant flying stork death kick?
Not on your life. all of those are just completely made up because, again, and it was odd because it was that same German class my freshman year in college.
Right.
We had to meet 5 days a week for 2 or 3 hours every morning from 7 till 10 and sprechen nur Deutsch. You can only speak German. And once before the class was started, I was sitting around with a bunch of other students, and there was this guy telling a story about his weekend. And he was saying, "Okay, and then we're going down this hill, and we're going, and we hit the brakes, and we go around this corner, and a woman stopped him, and she goes, "Why is it that when guys tell a story, they always got to use sound effects? But when women tell a story, they never use sound effects." And so even from when I was 18, 19, I was fascinated by how people can use onomatopoeia as a transitional device. And I always wanted to experiment with that. So the slash pow, kip wham, sock wham, hyphenated phrases in Pygmy just act as these experimental transitional devices. And it was a blast to do that.
You know, was Pygmy hard? It's funny. Pygmy's not a book you have to learn how to read as you read it. You kind of really have to immerse yourself and kind of get the lay of the land. Did you have to teach yourself how to write it as you were doing it with your own rules, or how did the writing process go?
Sorry, it was like speaking German. And right from the get-go, I decided really specific rules. For example, Pygmy doesn't know the word "the," and he doesn't know the word "and," and he doesn't know the word "again," and he can't say adjectival phrases like "Sesame Street." He has to say "Street of Sesame." He has to say "paste of tooth." He can't put together those compound words, and he can't put together like "unhappy." He has to say "no happy." So there was just infinite, very intentional mistakes in Pygmy, and I had to make up these long rules of what I had intentionally, consistently done wrong, because I knew that once this whole thing got turned over to the copy editor would go insane.
I was going to ask you, I mean, he or she must have wanted to strangle you after getting your manuscript.
But if when I gave it with the kind of the rules of Pygmy, which were 4 pages, single-spaced, intentional redundancy, baby chick, male boy, arm limb, red color, yellow red, color yellow, things that I had consistently done wrong. The copy editor was just, you know, happy as a pig in shit because they had the rules to go by.
Their style sheet was already there for
exactly.
them. They were all set.
Yeah.
That's great. Wow. It's funny. A lot of novelists, you know, always say that with every book they write, they're trying to, you know, learn how to do it all over again. It's like a new thing. With you, you really do that because every book seems it takes a different form. You have, like, Snuff was a multiple narrator novel. Haunted was kind of a collection of short stories in a novel form. And now this, you know, is a new, almost a new language. Do you seek out, you know, stories that fit a certain form, or do you have a form and look for a story? How do you know, what comes first in that chicken and egg thing?
There's, I talked a little about this the last time I was in Philly in this exact same room. Talked about how if you take a nonfiction form, it allows you to tell a fictional story that's even more incredible because it's lent credibility, it's lent reality by a nonfiction form. And my favorite examples of that are War of the Worlds, about Martians coming to Earth with a death ray. Yeah. Silly story, but if you place it within the context of news broadcasts on the radio, it has a gravity and reality. Or Citizen Kane, which is told in a newsreel format. Or Blair Witch Project, which was told as lost documentary footage. Or even Fargo, which is that magnificent dark comedy. But at the very beginning, it has a single card that says the following events are based on the truth. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. Some form of that, which is completely bullshit. They just put that there because they knew it would change the tone. It would lend gravity to that farcical story. So one thing I'm always trying to do is look for nonfiction structures that will lend gravity to an outrageous story. And also will handle the transition, handle the structuring, because they establish a cultural precedent. You know how the Three Bears story goes. Mm-hmm. The bears live in a house. They make porridge. They have to leave because it's too hot. Goldilocks breaks in. They discover Goldilocks. So you can really monkey with that story because the cultural precedent is already present in people's minds. And it gives you a greater freedom to really go crazy with a story because you don't have to worry about the structure.
What's actually cool is it's almost the inverse of the so-called nonfiction novel, where nonfiction writers would use the literary devices to tell their nonfiction story. You do the opposite almost. It's sort of using that kind of great nonfiction form to tell these wild stories. And you're right, it does works wonderfully. It makes you think, is this real? At some level, you think, with Pygmy, reading Pygmy, it was almost wondering, God, that's how they see us. I mean, how much fun was that, looking through Pygmy's eyes at, us and, America?
And it's, people will think it's a political novel, but it's not so much a political novel as it is a really sort of personal human novel in that... How old are you?
I have to tell? No, I'm kidding. I'm 37.
You're 37? I'm 47, so that makes me officially the oldest person in this building. And most of us, when we're 13, 14, before we're 13, 14, 15 years old, before that, our parents are supreme. Our parents are glorious. Our parents know everything, and they are all powerful, and they are fantastic. They're heroes to us. But as we turn 13, 14, it flips, and they become the tyrannical, idiot, bullying asshole. And that's how we treat them. We treat them like the enemy for, in my case, 4 years, 5 years. And we go from loving them and adoring them and finding no fault with them to absolutely finding nothing redemptive about them. And then eventually we come back around to adulthood where we accept them as just fellow flawed adults who are just doing their best. And so in a way, Pygmy is that 13-year-old us who is, to him, the Americans are these hideous oppressors that he despises. And by the end of the book, he comes into adulthood and just accepts them as human beings.
So is it that he hates them but is also confused by how Americans act? Is that by part of the confusion of these figures?
Well, when we're children, and I'll take it to Fight Club. When we're children, we're Jack. And we have been taught how to do it. We want a blueprint. We want a formula. We want a plan. We want people to say, how do I do this? How can you guarantee me success and happiness? And we will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in master's programs at college saying, how do I do this right? We so want to do it right, and we want someone to dictate how to do it right. And Pygmy grew up in this fascist totalitarian state, learning exactly everything that he thinks he should know. And then as he leaves it, and he discovers that the world is not exactly the way he was taught, he begins to mature, and he begins to come up with his own set of morals and ethics, which is all what we all have to do. And so, again, going back to Fight Club, you started out as Jack, that good kid, that good guy with the clean fingernails and the vacuum department, who's done everything that people have always told him to do that would make him happy. Gotta, you know, get A's, get married, get a degree, get a career. And then he overreacts and he becomes Tyler, who is a complete negation of that. But eventually, he finds a middle ground between the two, between the obedient child and between the hideous rebel.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to ask you about your writing process a little bit. One thing that fascinated me, I read about you, how you work and how you write your novels, is that you do kind of a lot of live workshopping. You'll actually talk about, you know, your stories in advance a little bit and maybe try things out on friends and also get sort of get details from people you talk to. Other writers I know kind of sometimes write their books under strict, you know, lock and key clamp down. They won't say a word about it until it's done and almost printed. You know, what do you get from the sort of, you know, the open, the way you write your novels? You know, the open environment, I guess.
I know the answer. I'm just want to make sure I phrase it well. When I started out writing, it was in a workshop in Tom Spanbauer's kitchen. And he had a little kitchen table, and he had four students. And every Thursday night, we came together and presented our work, and then responded to each other's work. And that wasn't even the best part of the workshop. The best part of the workshop was after that, when we drank wine and it turned into a little party. And once a week, if I brought work, I got to go to this party. And if I didn't bring work, I wasn't welcome at the party. So it was this peer support structure that expected me to produce work every week. And I got this social reinforcing from people. And if it was funny, they laughed. And if it was shocking, they gasped. And that was always much more useful than any kind of highbrow critique, you know, based on MFA rules. Right. And so it was just being able to go to that party every week. And that was in 1991. And that same group of us, for the most part, still gets together every Thursday night. And these are the longest friendships I've ever had because they're not based on proximity. They're not based on the fact that we just happen to live next door to each other or just happen to work together or just happen to be students in the same classes. They're based on the fact that we all have a passion for this thing that the world may not see a lot of value in. But when we come together, we reinforce the value for each other. And we make it okay for each other to be doing this thing. And we make it not okay for each other not to be doing this thing. Because the big question is, do you have pages this week? And if you say no, the big question is why?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about it. Why aren't you working? And so that social reinforcement and these lifelong friendships are the best paycheck I could ever get. And for years, they were the only paycheck I got because nobody was buying my work. People have died in our workshop. People have had kids. People have gotten married. People have gotten divorced. And we've seen each other now through almost 20 years of not just fiction, but of each other's lives.
Do you keep those friends in mind when you write all the time or occasionally when you're, you know, trying to get, reach a certain effect or have a certain, you know, joke? Do you want to sort of want to get the reaction right away as you're writing?
No, not really. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I really don't write for an ideal reader. I've got a couple friends who don't laugh at anything. And I write for them, typically.
That makes sense. So the Barracuda Death Gouge. No, I'm kidding. Actually, I have a few questions, if you don't mind, that I posted on Facebook, the arbiter of our day. I'll be talking to you, and I asked for questions, and I have a few questions from Facebook people. Do you mind a few of those questions?
Okay. What's Facebook?
It's a waste of time, basically. Yeah, you know. This is from Andrew M., who wants to know, are you the greatest Ukrainian since Trotsky? All right, that works.
Yeah, my last name is Ukrainian, and that's one of the sort of secrets of Pygmy is that a lot of the Slavic names in Pygmy, Tanak, Pavel, Metro, are named after, are lifted from my grandparents' Ellis Island immigration papers. I had a great uncle named Metro Polonek.
That's great.
And a little bit of their sentence structure or their speaking is lifted from some of the oldest members of my family.
That's funny. So. Well, I'll tell Andrew yes. No. one question from Christopher R. is, will Snuff be made into a stage production anytime soon? It seems tailor-made for a kind of Waiting for Godot with porn.
Snuff was originally written as a play.
Really? Really? Wow.
I wanted to write a play, and I'd written a draft, which only the first act of which actually translates into the book. The second two acts were much more deeply profound. And my agent arranged a reading at the Actors Studio in Los Angeles. And several really well-known, really accomplished actors came together, including some people from Fight Club. And they had this reading in which they read it on stage, and their agents and friends sat in the audience. And it went over like a shit-filled balloon. It was awful. So I ended up throwing away basically two-thirds of it and turning it into a book. But that was just a terrible, terrible day. You think that you reach a point in life where you can't fuck it up anymore? You think that there's this magic level you can get to where you won't go on the radio and say, I'm sorry I gassed to death so many German people. But life is just filled with mistakes that you have no idea that you can make.
All right, one last question. I'm just curious about, Fight Club was made into the film, obviously. Choke was made into a film recently. It's kind of a 10-year span between the two. How is the experience different for you? You have a bigger role in Choke, or did you have a different, experience with it than Fight Club?
It was a very, very similar experience.
Really?
The truth is still that, oh boy, I got a degree in journalism because I have no idea how to be with people. I don't know if you noticed upstairs that gigantic, gigantic trophy. I have no idea when people say, I want to have a picture with you. I don't know what to do. So I'm always looking for something that we can be doing in that picture that will that will imply a narrative other than the two of us standing there going, but whatever you young people do. And so that's why I got a degree in journalism, because a journalist knows what he or she is supposed to do in the situation. They're supposed to ask questions. There's a structure dictated to the social interaction. Because without that structure, without that prop, I have no idea what to do. And so looking for that kind of nonfiction context prop, like with the trophy, oh my gosh. If you want to be popular, go spend $70 and get a big plastic piece of crap trophy put together and walk down the street anywhere. Everybody, it is their introduction to, I mean, everybody is coming up and going, congratulations, oh my gosh, what is this? In New York, just running from the cab into my hotel, a distance of like 8 feet, past a couple people who were standing in front of the hotel, this one guy looks at me and he goes, I don't know what it is that you do, but you are the best. And before I came here this afternoon, the room service server brought lunch up, and she saw that giant trophy, and she goes, oh my gosh, she goes, you want to meet women, you walk down the street with that, and you won't go to bed alone tonight. And if you really want to mess with them, and they say, what'd you win? You can make up anything. So, you know, I don't write hoping that a movie is going to get made. Mm. And so subsequently, you know, I just write so I can go to the party on Thursday night.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so subsequently, when the movie is made, it's a little uncomfortable because I don't have a job. Mm. I'm kind of going as the tourist or as the author. And what do you do? So in a way, I turn into the journalist and I start talking to people about, you know, what is it that you do?
Yeah.
And that is the, that becomes the fun part. When they were filming Choke, and they were filming it at this closed down huge mental hospital in New Jersey, and it was late at night, and Sam Rockwell was ladling chocolate pudding into Angelica Houston. And she was gagging, and every time Clark Gregg said, cut, an assistant director would step in with this big Tupperware, and Angelica Houston would just barf this pudding into it. And she had pudding all over herself. And at one point, she got up to change costumes because she was so coated with this stuff. And she stops in front of me in the hallway, and she points at this mess of pudding all over her, this Hollywood star. She's nose to nose with me, and she goes, you did this to me. And I said, oh, thank God, because I had no idea what to say to her.
That's great. Okay, now it's time to throw it out for two questions and...
Right, this works. I have two mics. hi. This has nothing to do with Pygmy. We, a handful of friends here, took a seminar class and we had the opportunity to read Survivor for our seminar class. Thank you to our awesome professor right here. He's the greatest. Yeah. sorry. Tender. All right, whatever. Tender Branson. Do you find that the publicity that you've gained from your books, you based Tender off of that publicity? Like, do you find any of that in your own life?
Ooh, that's such a complex question.
Yeah, maybe for Fight Club. Because with Fight Club, I went from this sort of self-directed object that writes the story. And it's a really hard transition, I think, when you go from this self-directed object that has to create the story, has to create the story whether or not there's a paycheck, create the story before there's an agent or a contract or anything, has to be completely self-starting and getting this thing started and done. You go from being that dynamic, disciplined object to being this completely passive package that gets carted around and moved from one interview to another interview to another interview. And And you have to kind of let go of all of this drive that's gotten you to that point and become this thing that is kind of completely okay with being steered and directed. And that was really, really tough for me. It was really schizophrenic. I would find myself going to parties and expecting people to interview me. So, and nobody would, because people aren't that way. But subsequently, when I find that if I spend the entire year inflating penguins and creating this structure that allows me to continue to be this self-directed agent in the context of promotion, I'm a lot more happy, because I feel like I have some control, and that steering, controlling, disciplined part of me can still, you know, can still feel like, you know, I'm running the show. So.
Great. Okay.
One more.
Question two. All right. Just the fellows, just the boys here, just the guys. Right here, all right, right here in front. Yes, the black T-shirt.
If you could fight anyone in the world, who would you fight?
Oh, I hate that question. You know, I never had a big battle royale with my father. My father and I were just always very, very polite to each other. And I think that it would have been really great. I wish we'd had the chance to, and not necessarily fight, but I wish that we had been something other than just polite and nice to each other. And now he's gone. But, you know, I wish that we had really had that enormous, enormous showdown scene. So, yeah, that would be nice.
Excellent. Thank you.
On your mark, get set, blow! Not fair. Not fair. Okay. Penguins are gone. Okay, one last story. Case study cloaked operative. Courageous female operative at once time undertook mission to deliver emergency sustenance unto distant famished elderly relative. Attired in costume of appropriate modesty, operative adorned own self concealed within cloak with head covering crafted of red color fabric, provision basket for cartage bread foodstuffs, female operative embark upon foot, journey to navigate treacherous route amongst plentiful natural resources, much densely planted tree. Amid most dense forested journey, encounters cloaked operative, usurious American representative, card of credit company, disguised to appear as wolf animal, Apparent wolf, make offer unto operative. Promise for to carry burden of consumer debt, charging only solely mere 24% interest rate. Such crippling interest rate. Such typical nefarious American money lending institution. Seeming wolf tempt operative. Attempt for excite hooded female using decadent consumer goods. Corrupt pleasure of mealtime spent in restaurant. Exorbitant priced sweetened drinks crafted from pulverized beans of coffee bush, mixed frothing milk, served with an extravagant single-use vessel crafted of paper. United States Wolf promise all needs, all desires to be met through utilization of such disastrous card of credit. Casting aside cloak of red color fabric, revered operative, execute perfect killer kangaroo kick sock for cripple fake wolf. Operative sink own nail of fingers for open all blood veins of wolf, so allow all every hot pumping drop jetting red color of wolf blood for exit. Heroic operative, remove wolf head off wolf shoulders. Lifting head while showered in hot raining blood of moneylender. Noble operative, full volume, voice keening. Operative victorious, shouting. Bidding all, top present, most nobles, operatives present. Sweet dreams. Bidding comrades, good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.